standing ground. We shall fight in the field.
Statsbøttekottet.
Mer demokrati,
mer åpenhet og mer statsbøttekottet.
Hei og velkommen til en ny serie om komparativ politikkdelen av Politusen. Med oss i studio for hele denne serien postdoktor Kathleen Jennings.
Postdoktor Jennings foreleser for KP-delen av Politusen og amerikansk. Vi har derfor bestemt oss for at denne serien spilles inn på engelsk.
God fornøyelse.
Statsbøttekottet.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Statsbøttekottet with me, Lars, and Andreas.
This is one of four episodes in the summary podcast series in Poll 1000 for comparative politics. This podcast series will try to summarize the syllabus on the subject. The series is not intended as a substitute for reading the syllabus, but as a supplement.
During this series, we will cover the topics key concepts and state formation, Møller's control logic, forms of rule and ideology, and state structure and governance.
For this series, we are proud to have Kathleen Jennings, postdoctor and lecturer in Poll 1000, as our guest. Postdoctor Jennings has studied both at Stanford and Oxford, and she took her doctorate in political science at the University of Oslo. She's lecturing here at NTNU in Poll 1000, Comparative Politics. Welcome to our podcast, Postdoctor Jennings.
Thank you. Nice to be here. Thank you.
The theme for this episode is forms of rule and ideology. To start off, democracy is one of the most common forms of rule at the moment. What are the key characteristics of democracy?
Democracies most fundamentally are states where the people have a say in their government. And that normally is done by means of elections. It's important to stress that a country can have elections and not be democratic. And if those elections are essentially kind of for show or sort of fixed by the regime. But if we're looking at democracies, we're talking about places that have forms of government based on participation. People go to vote. Representation. People vote for people who then represent them in government. We're talking about regimes that have a separation of powers between three branches of government. So the judiciary, the domina, the executive, the utövna, and the legislative, which is lovgivna. And we're talking about a regime or a sort of state that has what Norwegians call a rettsstat. So there's a sort of constitutional authority that the state respects the rule of law. It's very difficult to have a democracy where there's no functioning rettsstat. So these hang together as well. So the main kind of components of democracy is participation, representation, and some sort of balance of power and sort of checks and limits on exercise of power through the means of a functioning sort of constitutional state or rettsstat.
What are like the differences between states and regime?
So the states, as a general rule, states don't change, regimes do. Obviously, states do change. We've seen that at the end of the Cold War. We see that sometimes boundaries change or there are wars fought over that. But for the most part, states are stable. They're pretty fixed. They have territory, they have population, they have a legitimate form of government. Regimes are the governments themselves. And so political scientists don't, when we say regimes, we're talking very neutrally. A lot of sort of common usage when people say regime, it's sort of negative. But for political scientists, we're basically talking about the government at any given time is a regime. So you could say the sort of a Gahr Støre regime. That's not a word, again, that most Norwegians would say. But that refers to the government that is now happening. And at the next general election, there might be a new regime. The state itself, of course, is not going anywhere.
We talked in short about democracy, but obviously not every state has a democracy rule. Another form of rule is authoritarianism. What are some characteristics of that?
Yeah, I mean, authoritarianism is almost defined against democracy in a way, because it's almost easier to say what authoritarian states aren't rather than what they are. There's quite a lot of variation. But you could generally say that authoritarian states are states that do not have participation and representation. And again, and very importantly, do not have this sort of balance of power and sort of checks on power. And again, it's not to say that there aren't elections or there aren't sort of the formal institutions in place that look like democratic states, but rather that those don't have any meaningful say. And so authoritarian states, they tend to be characterized by a very sort of personalized rule. So like a strong man, usually it's a strong man, or a party. So in China, for example, obviously you have a very, very strong president in China, but you also have the Communist Party, which is a very strong party apparatus. You have institutions that, again, exist sort of on paper and may play some kind of sort of moderating role sometimes, but that generally are quite weak. They're not able to provide a proper check on the ruler. Authoritarian regimes tend to have, well, almost uniformly have co-opted the media in some way and the opposition, which means that those in among the opposition and the media who haven't kind of gone along with or been sort of co-opted by the state either are shut down or are extremely weak, have very weak reach, or and often in danger of being imprisoned or otherwise vulnerable. So the general sort of characteristics of authoritarian rule is that you don't have a sort of functioning, again, Rechtsstaat, that where rule of law is sort of respected. Everything or things tend to be very personalized. So you go after your enemies, not people who've done wrong legally. And that institutions themselves don't work very well and don't act as a check on the leader.
In modern times, we've seen a lot of development in even the most stable democratic regimes. Like the U.S. has been the bulwark of democracy for the last hundreds of years. And the term we've been using is kind of a democratic backsliding. What is that?
I mean, democratic backsliding is one of these terms that political scientists love because you never really have to say what you mean. It kind of covers a lot of territory and people tend to know sort of intuitively what you're talking about. So if you were to try to define it, it's really difficult to define because, again, there's a lot of context. Country, it plays out different in different places. But what you're generally talking about is a weakening out of institutions, and especially those institutions that serve as a check on the executive, so on the president or the prime minister. So here we're talking especially about the courts being either their rulings not being respected or being so politicized that they really only kind of rule in favor of the ruling party. We're also talking about legislatures not being able to perform a kind of check or being completely controlled by the party that the leader controls. So we're basically talking about a process where sort of well-functioning democracies start to erode, where they don't haven't necessarily crossed the line into authoritarianism, but they're starting to kind of go down that path through the weakening of institutions, through, for example, in Hungary, the state media, the kind of anarcho equivalent, was completely taken over by Orban's people. This was, for the most part, legally done. He had the authority to install his sort of cronies in these positions. But the result, of course, was that all opposition voices essentially disappeared. The media became a propaganda arm for his government. So you see these kind of things that are happening. And oftentimes, it's not like everyone gets together and decides to weaken the institutions. It's more that politics has become, again, very kind of oftentimes very personalized. There's a lot of polarization and people are very kind of set on achieving their own power and goals. And the result of all of that is this sort of weakening of norms, weakening of institutions that then rebounds to the advantage of the leader, usually the president or the prime minister, who then can, you know, push the norms even further, break down the institutions even more, and you get in this kind of circle.
There is somewhat of an overlap between forms of rule and different ideologies. However, not every politician or rule has a clear ideology. What are the differences between forms of rule and ideology?
The ideologies that are on the sort of the farthest end of the spectrums, so that would be communism on the sort of the furthest left, fascism sort of on the furthest right, historically have not shown themselves to be very amenable to democracy. So they tend to be what we call totalitarian ideologies, where they are not horribly concerned with respecting the rights of individuals. That is actually kind of baked into the ideology itself. And regimes that aren't particularly concerned about respecting the rights of individuals do not tend to be democratic regimes or become democratic regimes. So in that sense, certainly that spectrum in between those two ends, which is to say sort of from the left, socialism, social democracy, liberalism, and then conservatism, those are the forms that are more sort of connected to democracy because both because of the sort of inhold, the sort of substance of the ideology themselves, and also the way that part of those ideologies is an acceptance of sort of the forms of government and the authority that these institutions have to actually rule. So even if you want to change or reform those institutions, you're not actually looking to get rid of the institutions themselves or take them over.
That leads us nicely into the next part, which is kind of what is an ideology?
I mean, an ideology is essentially a set of beliefs that have a sort of connected logic. They're sort of hang together. All these beliefs sort of hang together into an overarching logic, political logic. And when we talk about ideologies, we're not talking about, I just want to make a distinction between ideology and theory. Because if we're talking about theories that political scientists use, things like realism or constructivism or liberalism, we're talking about tools that political scientists use in order to explain the world as a political scientist sees it, right? If we're talking about ideologies, we're talking much broader. We're talking about beliefs that inform how we everyone as political beings situate ourselves in sort of a political space and understand the world. And so think of it this way. If you are walking down the street and you kind of just say to random people, hey, are you a liberal or a conservative? Most people would kind of be able to sort of answer, oh, I'm more liberal, or oh, I'm kind of more like socialist or whatever. But they would be able to situate themselves within, because we all kind of have an understanding of where we are in that kind of ideological spectrum. It's something that describes sets of beliefs that are shared and understood. Whereas theory, if you're walking down the street and said to someone, hey, are you a constructivist or a realist? They probably wouldn't know what you're talking about, because theories are tools used by political scientists to try to explain what we're interested in explaining. So those are the differences. Ideologies are sets of belief with a kind of that hang together with a coherent logic that help us understand the world that we're living in as political people, and that political parties also use to situate themselves, to communicate with voters, and to have a kind of basis for their political identity.
How do we use this in comparative politics, these ideologies or these theories?
I mean, again, so ideologies, as I say, are sort of useful for political scientists to understand because, again, they help connect us with the understandings that people have of the political system. And so when we're talking about ideologies, I mean, there is definitely a strong historical component here. So we're talking as well about sort of schools of thought that have developed over centuries into these kind of identifiable forms that, again, are kind of a shorthand for understanding politics and how political parties and politicians relate to each other and to the sort of political system. So I would say that if you're looking at ideology as a political scientist, it's something that you need to know, because it's almost like the language you have to be able to speak. Political scientists need to know what communism is and what liberalism is and stuff, because this is the political it helps us understand the political landscape we're all living in. In terms of theories, again, that's more of a tool for people to use in scholarship. It's not something that you relate to as just a sort of citizen going through the world.
There are some terms that are important when talking about society and ideologies. An important one is civil society. What is that?
civil society is basically everything that's kind of going on that's not in the political, explicitly in the political space or in political channels. And for most political scientists, you would kind of, the family doesn't really count as civil society. That's too private. But things like organized religion, things like sporting clubs, things like sort of groups that you're a member of, sort of Linjeforening would be a civil society organization, for example. So civil society basically is political scientists' attempt to conceptualize everything that goes on in terms of social organization outside of explicitly political channels. It's a very broad concept.
Related to that, we have terms like political culture. What is that?
Political culture is also a very broad concept. And it's, again, it's a very similar situation where political scientists are desperately trying to explain why you have different outcomes in different places, even though the institutional setup is very similar, for example. And one of the ways to help explain this is the notion of political culture, that some sort of that different countries have different political cultures that can sort of informally at least sort of set limits on what's sort of allowed, what's not allowed, what's going too far, that sets limits for debate in terms of, you know, in some countries the debate culture is very, very rough and harsh. In other countries, their debate is almost tamped down because it's seen as impolite. So political culture is essentially a way of describing the sort of cultural aspects of how politics and political institutions work. And that helps, again, political scientists have an extra sort of way to understand political outcomes that can't only be explained by how, like, the institutions are set up, basically.
And that takes us nicely into the next part, which is interest groups. They usually grow out of, as you said, like a Linjeforening or a worker society. And they're an important factor in modern politics. How do they function? Like, what is their role in Norway now, for example?
I mean, interest groups is challenging to talk about because it's quite a broad term. So there's a lot of different types of interest groups within that sort of umbrella term. So if you're talking about interest groups connected to kind of issues like human rights, that kind of thing, like you will think like Amnesty or Doctors Without Borders, these kind of groups that have a very important role in mobilizing, for example, public support, public pressure, using social media or protests, and that, you know, might have a sort of impact on politicians and policy because they're able to mobilize sort of public support, but that also themselves, again, are sort of more interested in sort of fronting campaigns and trying to sort of improve, you know, working in an idealistic way. And then you have interest groups kind of like First House, which is essentially a lobbying organization, which in Norway hasn't been as prominent as in places like the US and the UK, which has these very, very tight connections between lobbyists and people who govern. But I mean, a lobbying organization is basically you being usually a corporation will, you know, pay these people to go in and use their expertise and connections to try to influence legislators to give policy outcomes that you prefer. What's more common in Norway is the sort of union and this tripartite model where unions, employers, and the government work together collectively negotiate collectively for example, Tariffoppgjøret and these kind of things, and those are also considered interest groups, but they're brought into the government or they're brought into governing functions to create outcomes that are seen as mutually beneficial.
This was a little bit about forms of rule and ideology. There are three other parts to this series covering key concepts and state formation, Mueller's control logic, and state structures and governance. Thank you very much for the talk, Postdoctor Jennings. This conversation has certainly helped me a lot.
Oh, thank you. Thanks for inviting me.
And then we wonder if you have any like general tips for the exam or the exam time.
I mean, my general tip would be besides do the reading and look at the lecture notes, which are very comprehensive, the slides. There's a lot of words. would be not to get hung up on very small details. Without saying what's going to be on the exam, I can say that there's not going to be any kind of trick questions that if you haven't read page 72 of Mulid, you're not going to be able to answer the question. Like, we're not trying to trap people. What we're trying to do is test sort of if you have a solid understanding of some of these basic concepts and the sort of basic sort of what we've been discussing here in terms of institutions, in terms of some of the historical stuff, in terms of some of the methods, and can just sort of relate to these things in a sort of comprehensive enough way that shows that you have actually understood what's in the pensum, what we've been talking about in the lectures. But you don't need to know like all the very, very, very details. The main thing is to be able to tell a story about how all these things hang together and to understand how the different parts of these systems work sort of in concert or sort of pull against each other.
We hope this has been helpful for the exam study, and thank you for listening. We want you to remind you again that the curriculum podcast cannot replace reading, but are intended to supplement the busy exam period.
We also recommend following along because this podcast series has several other parts.
Statsbøttekottet. Mer demokrati, mer åpenhet og mer statsbøttekottet.